hey there. Welcome back to the Cory Doctorow podcast, recording this on November the 22nd, 2020, nearly at the end of an anno horribilis that will likely not be the worst year that you or I live through, given the direction travel, and yet it will be quite a milestone when it is finally over. Things are looking up a little bit here at our end. My pink eye is thankfully gone after a long, disgusting week of having my face stuck to my pillow every morning. That means that I can start swimming again in our local community pool, which is a great outdoor pool, practicing good social distancing. And that has been really good for my mental and physical health. We are getting ready for the end of the year and doing all that end of the year stuff around here. I am dry brining a turkey crown, which is another word for a turkey breast, with an eye to smoking it, which should be delicious. And we just gathered and submitted all of our papers for U.S. naturalization, it having been 5 years since we emigrated. And I went out and got 6 of my daughter's 8 Hanukkah presents yesterday. I'm going to have to get her a couple more. And so, yeah, getting all ready here for that stuff that happens when the days get short and the nights get long. And you hunker down and eat good food and, well, you don't get to see good friends the way you used to, but maybe you see them on video conference. The other thing that's going on this week is I am working hard to write a brand new speech, a speech summarizing my book that came out in August, How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism. And it's going to be a pretty major speech because I'm giving it back to back with Shoshana Zuboff, who wrote the book In the Age of Surveillance Capitalism, the book that my book responds to. We are co-delivering, I guess, the Beaverbrook Lectures at McGill University. Hers, I believe, is November the 29th, and mine's November the 30th. So 2 adjacent lectures. They're free to attend. I had given versions of the speech a lot before the book came out, but I have not written a brand new speech since the book came out to take account of all the stuff that I've heard since and try and pull it all together. So I did a lot of work on that yesterday. Do a little more work today, work on it through the week, and hope to have it done by the 30th. Some other talks that are coming up on the 26th of November, I'm keynoting the Cyber Summit 2020. On the 27th of November, I am presenting at Cologne Futures. And on the 1st of December, I am speaking in the Teach-In Against Surveillance. That is a group, afternoon-long series of talks, lectures, and panels in support of Ian Linkletter, who's a technologist at, I believe, at the University of British Columbia, who spoke out against the Proctorio spyware tool that's being used to invigilate exams there, and who has been sued by the vindictive CEO of Proctorio. So it's nice to see a chance to kind of stick up for the good guys. Apart from that, not much going on. I had a couple of really good viral threads on Twitter this week, and as ever, I kicked a couple of hornet's nests. I retweeted something from Tumblr, an anarchist poster that says, "Migrants aren't lowering your wages, your bosses." Something pretty anodyne like that. And it appears to have been the subject of a brigading attack by a group of white nationalists. So kind of, you know, 20 times a day I'm going in there and hiding these kind of neo-fascist responses, reporting the people who posted them and blocking the posters. There seems to be a never-ending supply. And looking at their feeds, I don't think they're bots. I think they are like a self-styled cyber militia who randomly picked this one tweet and decided to make it their hobby this week. It's been interesting to kind of live through that kind of asymmetric attack. And certainly it's helping me with the book I'm writing about white nationalist militias, The Lost Cause, my next novel, which is really getting close to being done, at least in first draft. I'm still on track, I think, to finish it by New Year's. So that is a very exciting thing. I will not be speaking to you next weekend. I'm going to take U.S. Thanksgiving off, not work that weekend. And I won't be speaking to you between December the 17th and January the 7th. I'm taking a very long holiday. I have not taken a single day off, not even a Saturday or Sunday, since the crisis started, since last March. And I'm going to take a really long, solid time off. Do some chores around the house, do some hiking, do some cooking, do some writing, do a lot of reading, spend some time with my family. That's my plan. I hope you've got a plan to take care of yourself too. Well, today I'm going to read to you part 24 of Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town. That's the novel I published in 2006. You obviously should not start listening with part 24. If you look in the show notes, there's a link to go back and find the earlier installments. I hope you do that. Other than that, not much to say. Here is part 24 of Someone Comes to Town, someone leaves town. He never understood how he came to be enrolled in kindergarten. Even in those late days, there were still any number of nearby farm folk whose literacy was so fragile that they could be intimidated out of it by a sheaf of school enrollment forms. Maybe that was it. The 5-year-old Alan, turning up at the school with his oddly accented English and his Martian wardrobe of pieces rescued from roadside ditches and snitched off of clotheslines. And who was going to send him home on the first day of school? Surely the paperwork would get sorted out by the time the first permission slip field trip rolled around, or possibly by the time vaccination forms were due. And then it just fell by the wayside. Alan got the rest of his brothers enrolled, taking their forms home and forging indecipherable scrawls that satisfied the office ladies. His own enrollment never came up in any serious way. Permission slips were easy. Inoculations could be had at the walk-in clinic once a year at the firehouse. Until he was 8, being undocumented was no big deal. None of his classmates carried ID. But his classmates did have big wheels, catcher's mitts, Batmobiles, action figures, Fonzie lunchboxes, and Kodiak boots. They had parents who came to parents' night and sent trays of cupcakes to class on birthdays. Alan's birthday came during the summer by necessity, so that this wouldn't be an issue. So did his brothers when their time came to enroll. At 8, he ducked show and tell religiously and skillfully, but one day he got caught out, empty-handed, and with all the eyes in the room boring into him as he fumfawed at the front of the classroom, and the teacher thought he was being kind by pointing out that his hand-stitched spring moccasins, a tithe of the golems, were a fit subject for a brief exposition. "Did your mom buy you any real shoes?" It was asked without malice or calculation, but Alan's flustered, red-faced, hot stammer chummed the waters, and the class sharks were on him fast and hard. Previously invisible, he was now the subject of relentless scrutiny. Previously an observer of the playground, he was now a nexus of it, a place where attention focused, hunting out the out-of-place accent, the strange lunch, the odd looks and gaps in knowledge of the world. He thought he'd figured out how to fit in, that he'd observe people to the point that he could be one. But he was so wrong. They watched him until Easter break, when school let out and they disappeared back into the unknowable depths of their neat houses, and when they saw him on the street, headed for a shop, or moping on a bench, they cocked their heads quizzically at him, as if to say, "Do I know you from somewhere?" Or if he was feeling generous, "I wonder where you live." The latter was scarier than the former. For his part, he was heartsick that he turned out not to be half so clever as he'd fancied himself. There wasn't much money around the mountain that season. The flakes he'd brought down to the assayer had been converted into cash for new shoes for the younger kids and chocolate bars that he'd brought to fill Bradley's little round belly. He missed the school library achingly during that week, and it was that lack that drove him to the town library. He'd walked past the squat brown building hundreds of times, but he had never crossed the threshold. He had a sense that he wasn't welcome there, that it was not intended for his consumption. He slunk in like a stray dog, hid himself in the back shelves, and read books at random while he observed the other patrons coming and going. It took 3 days of this for him to arrive at his strategy for getting his own library card, and the plan worked flawlessly. Bradley pulled the books off the back shelves for the final time, the librarian turned in exasperation for the final time, and he was off and out with the card in his hand before the librarian had turned back, credentialed. He had read the word in a book of war stories. He liked the sound of it. "What did Krishna do?" "What do you mean?" She was looking at him guardedly now, but his madness seemed to have passed. "I mean," he said, reaching over and taking her hand, "what did Krishna do when you went out for coffee with him?" "Oh," she said. She was quiet while they drove a narrow road over a steep hill. "He made me laugh." "He doesn't seem that funny," Alan said. "We went out to this coffee shop in Little Italy, and he sat me down at a tiny green metal table, even though it was still as cold as hell, and he brought out tiny cups of espresso and a little wax paper bag of biscotti. Then he watched the people and made little remarks about them. 'She's a little old to be breeding,' or, oh, is that how they're wearing their eyebrow in the old country? Or, looks like he beats his wife with his slipper for not fixing his Kraft dinner right. And when he said it, I knew it wasn't just a mean little remark. I knew it was true. Somehow he could look at these people and know what they were self-conscious about, what their fears were, what their little secrets were. And he made me laugh, even though it didn't take long before I guessed that that meant that he might know my secret. So we drank our coffee, she said, and then stopped when the body thudded in the trunk again when they caught some air at the top of a hill. We drank it, and he reached across the table and tickled my open palm with his fingertip and said, why did you come out with me? And I mumbled and blushed and said something like, you look like a nice guy, it's just coffee, shit, don't make a big deal out of it. And he looked like I just canceled Christmas and said, oh well, too bad, I was hoping it was a big deal, that it was because you thought I'd be a good guy to really hang out with a lot, if you know what I mean. He tickled my palm again. I was a blushing virgin, literally, though I'd had a couple of boys maybe, possibly, flirt with me in school. I'd never returned the signals. Never could. I told him I didn't think I could be romantically involved with him, and he flattened out his palm so that my hand was pinned to the table under it, and he said, if it's your deformity, don't let that bother you. I thought I could fix that for you. I almost pretended I didn't know what he meant, but I couldn't really. I knew he knew I knew. I said, how? As in, how did you know, and how can you fix it? But it just came out in a little squeak, and he grinned like Christmas was back on, and said, does it really matter? I told him it didn't, and then we went back to his place in Kensington Market, and he kissed me in the living room, and he took me upstairs to the bathroom, and he took off my shirt, and he cut you, Alan said. He fixed me, she said. Alan reached out and petted her wings through her jacket. Were you broken? Of course I was, she snapped, pulling back. I couldn't talk to people. I couldn't do anything. I wasn't a person, she said. Right, Alan said. I'm following you. She looked glumly at the road, unraveling before them, gray and hissing with rain. Is it much farther? She said. An hour or so, if I remember right, he said. I know how stupid that sounds, she said. I couldn't figure out if he was some kind of pervert who liked to cut, or if he was some kind of pervert who liked girls like me, or if I was lucky, or in trouble. But he cut them, and he gave me a towel to bite on the first time, but I never needed it after that. He'd do it quick, and he kept the knife sharp, and I was able to be a person again, to wear cute clothes and go where I wanted. It was like my life had started over again. The hills loomed over the horizon now, low and rolling up toward the mountains. One of them was his. He sucked in a breath, and the car wavered on the slick road. He pumped the brakes and coasted them to a stop on the shoulder. Is that it? She said. That's it, he said. He pointed. His father was green and craggy and smaller than he remembered. The body rolled in the trunk. I feel, he said. We're taking him home, at least. And my father will know what to do. No boy's ever taken me home to meet his folks, she said. Alan remembered the little fist in the dirt. You can wait in the car if you want, he said. Krishna came home, she said, as they sat in the parked car at a wide spot on the highway, looking at the mountains on the horizon. Krishna came home, she said, after he'd pulled off the road abruptly, put the car into park, and stared emptily at the mountains ahead of them. Krishna came home, she said, lighting a cigarette and rolling down the window and letting the shush of the passing cars come fill the car, and she didn't look at him because the expression on his face was too terrible to behold. And he came through the door with two bags of groceries and a bottle of wine under one arm and two bags from a raveware shop on Queen Street that I'd walked past 100 times but never gone into. He left me in his apartment that morning with his television and his books and his guitar and told me to make myself at home, told me to call in sick to work, told me to take a day for myself. I felt glorious, gloried in. He'd been so attentive. He touched me. No one had touched me in so long. No one had ever touched me that way. He touched me with reverence. He'd gotten this expression on his face like he was in church or something. He kept breathing something too low for me to hear, and when he put his lips right to my ear, I heard what he'd been saying all along, "Oh God, oh God, my God, oh God." And I felt a warmness like slow honey start in my toes and rise through me like sap to the roots of my hair, so that I felt like I was saturated with something hot and sweet and delicious. He came home that night with the makings of a huge dinner with boiled soft-shell crabs and a bottle of completely decent Chilean red and three dresses for me that I could never, ever wear. I tried to keep the disappointment off my face as he pulled them out of the bag because I knew they'd never go on over my wings, and they were so beautiful. "This one will look really good on you," he said, holding up a Heidi dress with a scoop neck that was cut low across the back, and I felt a hot tear in the corner of my eye. I'd never wear that dress in front of anyone but him. I couldn't. My wings would stick out a mile. I knew what it meant to be different. It meant living in the second floor with the old Russian auntie, away from the crowds and their eyes. I knew then what I was getting in for. The rest of my life, spent hidden away from the world, with only this man to see and speak to. I'd been out in the world for only a few years, and I had barely touched it, moving in silence and stealth, watching and not being seen, but oh, I had loved it, I realized. I'd thought I'd hated it, but I'd loved it. Loved the people and their dialogue and their clothes and their mysterious errands and the shops full of goods and every shopper hunting for something for someone, every one of them part of a story that I would never be part of. But I could be next to the stories, and that was enough. I was going to live in an attic again. I started to cry. He came to me. He put his arms around me. He nuzzled my throat and licked up the tears as they slid past my chin. "Shh," he said. "Shh." He took off my jacket and my sweater, peeled down my jeans and my panties, and ran his fingertips over me, stroking me until I quietened. He touched me reverently, still, his breath hot on my skin. No one had ever touched me like that. He said, "I can fix you." I said, "No one can fix me." He said, "I can, but you'll have to be brave." I nodded slowly. I could do brave. He led me by the hand into the bathroom, and he took a towel down off the hook on the back of the door and folded it into a long strip. He handed it to me. "Bite down on this," he said, and helped me stand in the tub and face into the corner to count the grid of tiles and the greenish mildew in the grout. "Hold still and bite down," he said, and I heard the door close behind me, reverent fingertips on my wing, unfolding it, holding it away from my body. "Be brave," he said, and then he cut off my wing. It hurt so much, I pitched forward involuntarily and cracked my head against the tile. It hurt so much, I bit through two thicknesses of towel. It hurt so much, my legs went to mush, and I began to sit down quickly, like I was fainting. He caught me under my armpits and held me up, and I felt something icy pressed to where my wing had been. I closed my eyes, but I heard the leathery thump as my wing hit the tile floor, a wet sound. And gauzy fabric was wrapped around my chest, holding the icy towel in place over the wound, once, twice, thrice, between my tits. "Hold still," he said, and he cut off the other one. I screamed this time, because he brushed the wound he'd left the first time, but I managed to stay upright and not to crack my head on anything. I felt myself crying, but I couldn't hear it. I couldn't hear anything, nothing, except a high sound in my ears like a dog whistle. He kissed my cheek after he'd wound a second bandage, holding a second cold compress over my second wound. "You're a very brave girl," he said. "Come on." He led me into the living room, where he pulled the cushions off his sofa and opened it up to reveal a hide-a-bed. He helped me lie down on my belly and arranged pillows around me and under my head so that I was facing the TV. "I got you movies," he said, and held up a stack of DVD rentals from Martian Signal. We got Pretty in Pink, The Blues Brothers, The Princess Bride, and a Robin Williams stand-up tape, and a really funny-looking porno called Edward Penis Hands. I had to smile in spite of myself, in spite of the pain. He stepped into his kitchenette and came back with a box of chocolates. Truffles, he said, so you can laze on the sofa eating bonbons. I smiled more widely then. Such a beautiful smile, he said. Want a cup of coffee? No, I said, choking it out past my raw from screaming throat. All right, he said. Which video do you want to watch? Princess Bride, I said. I hadn't heard of any of them, but I didn't want to admit it. You don't want to start with Edward Penis Hands? Alan stood out front of the video shop for a while, watching Natalie wait on her customers. She was friendly without being perky, and it was clear that the mostly male clientele had a bit of a crush on her, as did her mooning, cow-eyed co-worker, who was too distracted to efficiently shelve the videos he pulled from the box before him. Alan smiled. Hiring cute girls for your shop was tricky business. If they had brains, they'd sell the hell out of your stock and be entertaining as hell. But a lot of pretty girls and boys had gotten a free ride in life and got affronted when you asked them to do any real work. Natalie was clearly efficient, and Alan knew that she wasn't afraid of hard work. But it was good to see her doing her thing quickly and efficiently, taking people's money, answering their questions, handing them receipts, counting out change. He would have loved to have someone like her working for him in one of his shops. Once the little rush at the counter was cleared, he eased himself into the shop. Natalie was working for him, of course, in the impromptu assembly line in Kurt's storefront. She'd proven herself to be as efficient at assembling and testing the access points as she was at running the till. Alan, she said, smiling broadly. Her co-worker turned and scowled jealously at him. I'm going on break, okay? She said to him, ignoring his sour puss. What, now? He said petulantly. No, I thought I'd wait until we got busy again, she said, not unkindly, and smiled at him. I'll be back in 10, she said. She came around the counter with her cigs in one hand and her lighter in the other. Coffee? She said. Absolutely, he said, and led her up the street. You liking the job? He said. It's better now, she said. I've been bringing home 2 or 3 movies every night and watching them, just to get to know the stock. And I put on different things in the store, the kind of thing I'd never have watched before. Old horror movies, tentacle porn, crappy kung fu epics. So now they all bow to me. That's great, Alan said, and Kurt tells me you've been doing amazing work with him, too. Oh, that's just fun, she said. I went along on a couple of dumpster runs with the gang. I found the most amazing cosmetics baskets at the Shiseido dumpster. Never would have thought that I'd go in for that girly stuff, but when you get it for free out of the trash, it feels pretty matcha. Smell, she said, tilting her head and stretching her neck. He sniffed cautiously. Very matcha, he said. He realized that the older patrons in the shop were eyeballing him, a middle-aged man with his face buried in the Alterna girl's throat. He remembered suddenly that he hadn't put in a call to get her a job somewhere else, and he was smitten with guilt. Hey, he said, damn, I was supposed to call Tropical and see about getting you a job. I'll do it right away. He pulled a little steno pad out of his pocket and started jotting a note to himself. She put her hand out. Oh, that's okay, she said. I really like this job. I've been looking up all my old high school friends. You were right. Everyone I ever knew has an account with Martian Signal. God, you should see the movies they rent. You keep that on file, huh? Sure, everything. It's creepy. Do you need that much info? Well, we need to know who took a tape out last if someone returns it and says it's broken or recorded over or whatever. So you need what, the last couple months worth of rentals? Something like that. Maybe longer for the weirder tapes. They only get checked out once a year or so. So maybe you just keep the last 2 names associated with each tape? That'd work. You should do that. She snorted and drank her coffee. I don't have any say in it. Tell your boss, he said. It's how good ideas happen in business. People working at the cash register figure stuff out, and they tell their bosses. So I should tell my boss that I think we should change our whole rental system because it's creepy? Damn right. Tell him it's creepy. You're keeping information you don't need to keep and paying to store it. You're keeping information that cops or snoops or other people could take advantage of. And you're keeping information that your customers almost certainly assume that you're not keeping. All of those are good reasons not to keep that information. Trust me on this one. Bosses love to hear suggestions from people who work for them. It shows that you're engaged, paying attention to their business. God, now I feel guilty for snooping. Well, maybe you don't mention to your boss that you've been spending a lot of time looking through rental histories. She laughed. God, he loved working with young people. So, why I'm here, he said. Yes? I want to put an access point in the second floor window and around back of your shop. Your boss owns the building, right? Yeah, but I don't think I can explain all this stuff to him. I don't need you to. I just need you to introduce me to him. I'll do all the explaining. She blushed a little. I don't know, Abe. She trailed off. Is that a problem? No. Yes. I don't know. She looked distressed. Suddenly he was at sea. He felt like he was in charge of this interaction, like he understood what was going on. He'd carefully rehearsed what he was going to say and what Natalie was likely to say, and now she was, what, afraid to introduce him to her boss? Because why? Because the boss was an ogre? Then she would have pushed back harder when he told her to talk to him about the rental records. Because she was shy? Natalie wasn't shy. Because... I'll do it, she said. Sorry, I was being stupid. It's just, you come on a little strong sometimes. My boss, I get the feeling he doesn't like it when people come on strong with him. Oh, he thought. She was nervous because he was so goddamn weird. Well, there you had it. He couldn't even get sad about it. Story of his life, really. Thanks for the tip, he said. What if I assure you that I'll come on easy? She blushed. It had been really awkward for her then. He felt bad. Okay, she said. Sure. Sorry, man. He held up a hand. It's nothing. He followed her back to the store, and he bought a tin robot made out of a Pepsi can by some artisan in Vietnam who'd endowed it with huge tin testicles. It made him laugh. When he got it home, he scanned and filed the receipt, took a picture, and entered it into the inventory. And by the time he was done, he was feeling much better. All right, I'll talk to you in 2 weeks if you are in the United States of America. God help us all. And also, have a great Thanksgiving. If you are anywhere else in the world, well, you need all the help you can get too, I suppose. I will talk to you in 2 weeks and stay safe and COVID-free until then. Talk to you later.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, W-R-Y-N-E-C-K Studio, @gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.